The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank.
Hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year, which recognizes and celebrates the achievements of remarkable women who you've probably never heard of, but whose passion, dedication, hard work, and fierce determination have changed society, lives, and the world in all kinds of inspiring ways. In each episode, we'll be talking to an extraordinary woman about the experiences that led her to create the organization, found the charity, launch the campaign, or raise the profile of an issue that she simply couldn't sit by and allow to go unnoticed or unserved. We'll discover what motivates and moves her, the challenges she's faced, the joy she's experienced, the plans she has, and the lessons she's learned along the way. We'll also hear the sometimes surprising and funny answers to the four quickfire questions we ask each one of our extraordinary, ordinary women. I'm June Angelides. I'm an investor, entrepreneur, FT columnist, and board advisor, and I'm one of the presenters of this very special podcast. Later on, the other member of our gang, Leonie Mellinger, will be talking to one of the Women of the Year lunch guests who you most certainly will have heard of about what makes the event such a very special and inspiring experience. Now for this week's guest. In the celebrity seat is none other than Tamsin Althwaite, who we are thrilled to have with us. And this week's extraordinary ordinary woman is someone who has enabled parents in prison to stay in touch with their children in a very special way.
Sharon Berry founded Storybook Dads, a nonprofit charity which enables families to reconnect through the magic of storytelling. They help parents in prison to record bedtime stories and messages for their children on CD or DVD. I started off by asking Sharon how she founded Storybook Dads.
It sort of happened by accident, actually. I'd been volunteering in BBC Radio Devon and an appeal came in to help a local prison to set up a radio station with the writer in residence. So I went there to work with her. So it wasn't really my idea and it wasn't hers. She'd heard of it somewhere else, but we started to do Storybook Dads in this one particular prison just to trial it out because we'd heard that, you know, an officer had done it many, many years ago. And we tried it out and it worked well. And then it fizzled out because there was no money for it. I then went on to become a teacher in prison, in two prisons in Devon, and just still kept thinking about Storybook Dads and how important it was and it needed really to be autonomous and have funding. So that's when I started as a charity, really just through talking to the guys, you know, and they'd often just talk about their children when they're on their own. They don't usually do it in front of their mates. But and that's the thing about prison, you have to be kind of tough in prison, you know. They do have to have a tough exterior and keep up a sort of macho facade as much as they can. But I got to kind of know them and realise that they really miss their children. Their children really miss them. And actually, Storybook Dads is such a simple idea. You just record them and then we upload the story onto a computer and we use digital software, which is the software I'd learned to use at the BBC, which was handy, to take mistakes out and put sound effects in. So if there's wizards or dragons or, you know, farm animals, and send the disc to the child. It's such a simple idea, but it became quickly apparent just how effective it was, because before I knew it, really, more and more prisons wanted to get involved. So I'd started the charity in Dartmoor Prison in 2003, thinking it would stay there and maybe a couple of other little local jails. And then just more and more prisons wanted to join, and then it just kind of grew from there, really, in quite an astonishing rate.
That is absolutely amazing. And the moms, I presume, that soon followed after working with dads?
Yeah, it did. First, like I say, I thought it was just going to be the Southwest prisons. And then women's prisons wanted to join as well. But by that time, we'd already become quite well known as Storybook Dads. We'd won a couple of awards and people had heard of us and the prison service knew us. Because, of course, at first that was a little difficult because not everybody sees the value in it. You might get some sort of say, why do you want to record big tattooed prisoners reading Goldilocks? What's it all about? You know, they don't really get it. So, you know, in the beginning, it was quite tough to get it off the ground and to demonstrate the benefits of it to everybody, to the prison service, to the governors, to the prison officers, to the prisoners themselves in some cases, because they didn't always feel they could do it. They're too shy, they're too embarrassed, they can't read very well, whatever the barriers may be. So it took some time, and then Storybook Mums came on board as well. We've recently actually bought 8 video cameras for 8 women's prisons so that they can do DVD mums, because most of the women's prisons are just still doing audio, but we do DVD as well. So that's even nicer, because you can film the parent reading a book, and we've got the pages of the book scanned in, so the pictures go in as well, and then we can send the DVD home to the children. They can see mom or dad and the pictures of the book. So yeah, we're in all the women's prisons as well now, which is great.
I absolutely love it. Oh, I mean, for me, I can only imagine. I mean, just that thing of just not having one parent around and just having the sense of connection. And but also on the prisoner side, I mean, it must instill so much confidence in them, a sense of purpose, which I imagine after you've been, you know, locked away for quite a long time, must be really hard to hold on to.
Yeah, and there's so little they can do for their children from prison. There are phone calls, but most prisons, as far as I'm aware, still, the prisons are all locked up by 6 o'clock at night. Some prisons have got in cell phones, but that's not the majority of them. And so they can't phone their families when they're all home at the same time. And so it's really restrictive. Visits can be difficult because they could be a long way from home. And who wants to take two little children on a long train journey and, you know, a bus journey to a prison where they... Well, as it, you know, when lockdown happened, they weren't able to do that at all, but they're starting to bring that in. But, you know, visits can be difficult, phone calls can be difficult. But at least with this, the child has got their DVD or their CD that they can play whenever they're missing their mum or dad. And as you say, it does bring a great sense of purpose, and they can do something positive for their children from behind bars, which is really difficult to do, and encourage children to read and to enjoy storytelling and just have meaningful contact with their children. And sometimes prisoners are quite reluctant to do it because they're too shy. I don't know about you, but I never liked reading aloud when I was young in class, and you had to take turns of reading aloud. I hated it, and it's nerve-wracking, and you know, you just feel a bit silly. Sometimes they don't know what book to pick because they don't know the age appropriate thing, and they weren't read to as children. So we've got a very nurturing environment. We guide them through that, and we say, what does your little girl like? Is she princessy or tomboy? You know, what should we go for? And try and make them relax and have a bit of fun. And more often than not, once somebody's done one recording, then they'll be back. They realise the benefit of it, and then they want to come back and do more. And it gives them something else to talk about on the phone. So it's just got incredible value and just so simple.
I agree. Totally agree. I think it's such a genius idea. What is your big vision for Storybook Dads? Do you want this to go global? I know you're working with the Navy.
Well, what we did do was we helped the Army and the Navy and the Air Force to copy our model. We don't really work with them because our funding is for prisoners' children, but we did train them in the audio production. So we helped, so Storybook Soldiers was born, Storybook Waves and Storybook Wings. So we did help them. And sometimes if they had too many stories to edit themselves, they sent them to us, and our team did the production for them. In terms of global, I mean, there's still a lot to be done in this country, to be honest, because, you know, there are, the population is 85,000 or something like that. And we do about 5,000 or 6,000 stories a year. So there's lots of room to expand in this country to help prisons to improve their provision or get some new prisons started. We're in most of them, we're in about 100, but there's still, you know, about 30 left. So really, we just want to concentrate on what we're doing here. But that's not to say we haven't helped other countries. There's Storybook Dads in Australia. We went to Denmark. We went to Poland. So we've been to several other countries, and we're quite happy to share our resources and our expertise. You know, we're not precious about it. We'll help anybody we can. But our actual funding is for prisoners' children in the UK.
You know, the aim of this podcast is to get a sense of you. And you know, I really want to know, what is it that you love the most about what you do?
It's just the feedback that we get, really, from the prisoners, the prisoners' families and the children. Just, you know, when I go into prison and some of the lads would come up and say, "Oh, miss, my little boy, he loved that recording. He plays it over and over again. His mum's getting sick of the Gruffalo. He'll have to do another one." It's just the feedback you get. I don't go into the prisons as much as, well, lockdown changed all that anyway. But I mean, I work from home quite a lot, but I usually go in once a week. And it's just seeing the changes that occur and just the difference that it makes. It's really inspiring. And all the people that work for Storybook Dads just love their job. Feels good to be there knowing how much you're helping.
Oh, it must be such a wonderful feeling. Do you get to interact with the families that have received the stories?
Not so much, because, you know, our main core work is recording in the prisons. That's what we do. We work within the prison, recording the prisoners. Having said that, we get lots of inquiries on our website. Sometimes somebody will have a question and I'll speak to them directly. So I do get to speak to families, although we rarely get to meet them. Sometimes if we're having a little workshop in a family visits day, we will. So we might do a little workshop with the mum and the children or something. But normally it's mainly the prisoners and feedback that we get from the families in terms of just the feedback forms or comments on our website, or sometimes they just want to talk to us about something. So that's how we get to speak to them.
I imagine that you know, there's so many emotions that go into this. Obviously a lot of joy, you know, a lot of responsibility, keeping families together, keeping them connected. Just on a personal level, as Sharon, how do you find ways to sort of separate work and life and what's going on, you know, thinking of the dads, and, you know, do you find that quite emotional?
Yeah, I used to more at first. I mean, I've been working in prison now for 18 years now, so I've got a little more used to it in sort of stepping away from it. But, you know, sometimes, say if I've been in prison, because sometimes I actually still do the recordings, I like to actually be there on the coalface with the guys sometimes. And when they come to record, they can be ever so nervous, and they may not have been read to when they were children. They may not have read to their children. They're ashamed of what they've done. And sometimes they break down and cry before they can even start. And that sort of thing, then they stick in your mind a little bit. The longer I've worked in prison, the easier it's become in terms of being able to switch off. But that's not to say that sometimes when you do go in and you speak to certain prisoners or somebody's broken down, or even a family member. I was speaking to a family member a couple of weeks ago, and she was telling me her story. And then I thought about her and her plight afterwards, especially during lockdown. It's been particularly tough, of course, because the prisoners were just all locked up and that was it. No visits, no nothing. So a lot of families found that difficult, and a lot of prisoners found that difficult. So this past year has been exceptional in terms of being able to disconnect, because we realise how much they've all been suffering this year, or last year, and a bit of this year.
In some ways, has it made Storybook Dads even more important in finding, you know, that sense of connection for kids who haven't been able to visit their dads?
Yeah, definitely. And some families, you know, that perhaps the relationship wasn't terribly strong, maybe breaking down, or so there is a greater need for it now. Not all the prisons, even now, are back able to record again yet. They still have, maybe that'll change from today a little bit more, but, you know, they were still having to have social distancing and not letting too many prisoners out at once so they could keep them apart. So of the 100 member prisons, probably we're getting on for about half of them are back recording again. But even now, whereas life has sort of virtually returned to normal for us outside, pretty much, it's not quite the same yet in prison. So, but there is a definite need for Storybook Dads and Storybook Mums now to come back in force to try and, you know, help the families to reconnect and improve their relationships.
And so, Sharon, how do you keep stretching yourself? And it's not to say you're doing so many amazing things, but I imagine, you know, that vision keeps getting bigger and bigger. And I wanted to understand how you keep yourself accountable. Is there someone you work with? Is there a mentor, a role model you have in your life?
No. Well, we've got a board of trustees, but I think I work mainly with my colleagues. So there's three of us sort of in the management team that discuss things and talk about things. And do you think this will work? Do you think that'll work? And for instance, when lockdown happened and suddenly we couldn't record anymore, you know, we didn't have access to prisoners. We weren't allowed in the prison, and neither was anybody else except the officers. And that was it. And I thought, what are we going to do? So then we had to develop and change. So we sort of reversed it. So we got families to send in little videos of the children from their phone, like little 5-minute films of the children in the garden, or it was mainly in the garden then because it was so hot,
you
know, or a birthday party or somebody's birthday. And so we managed to reverse it and think on our feet and do that, because then you've got a DVD, you can just slip it under the prisoner's door. For him, you don't have to have face-to-face contact. And we did the same. We got some activity packs that were quite fun to fill in, sent a pack to the child, sent a pack to mum or dad, with the identical activity sheets that they filled in and learned about each other, what they like to eat, what films, what books they like, things like that. So, and there's always something going on that you need to deal with, you know, like a prison. They haven't got the facilities to do it. They can't find somewhere quiet to do it. They need a volunteer. They need training. So there's always, you know, there's never plateaus. There's always something that in this, you know, in our prisons that a problem or a barrier that needs to be overcome. So there's quite enough to keep me stretched, really.
Have you always been good at problem solving ever since you were a young lady? Is that something that...
I don't think so, not really. I don't know. I don't really know the answer to that question. I think I've always been, like to fix things, I guess, and make things right, if that could be a way of looking at it. But no, I don't know. So in terms of, like I say, accountability, now we've got, you know, our management team, and we talk a lot with the prisoners and the other staff on what's going to work and what's not going to work. So it's kind of a group effort. In the beginning, it was a bit of a one woman show. You know, I admit that. And I used to work 70, 80 hours a week when it was growing. But I did learn to delegate. That can be difficult when it's something you started yourself, you know, and that was probably a fault of mine in the beginning. I thought, no, I've got to do that, and I've got to do that, and I've got to do that. You know, I've got to do the accounts, I've got to do the annual report and answer all the media questions and go into prison, you know, and it was just crazy.
It's a lot. A lot of hats. And I think not many people appreciate what the early days are like when you start a business, how taxing it is on
it
you.
It was. It would be the phone ring. They say, oh, can I speak to somebody in finance? Yes, hang on a second.
Yes.
Yep, that's me. You know. But I did learn to delegate, unfortunately, too, because I couldn't have kept up that work pace. And actually, they're better than me, you know, at specific tasks. I'm quite good at being a sort of trailblazer, I suppose. But, you know, some of the methods I used for office were just not very efficient. So it was much better when I learned to delegate and trust other people to do the job better than I could.
Absolutely. I often say that's one of the things I learned the hard way, learning to hire people who are way better than me and can get it done.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so much easier now.
So true. Did you ever think of doing anything else? Has that thought ever crossed your mind?
No, not since I've been doing this. No, it just took over. You know, and I never thought I would be doing this. You know, I left school when I was 16. That's when girls really just became hairdressers or worked in offices or whatever, or care homes. And I just had those kind of jobs, you know, worked in care homes and worked around the bar and things like that. I did quite a bit of traveling because I wanted to travel. And I never really saw myself being in a different kind of life. And it wasn't until, because I used to work in a pub, when was quite an eclectic mix of people who would come in at lunchtime. One of them was a lecturer, a university lecturer, and he persuaded me to go and do an A-level in the evening, which I did. And then he persuaded me to go to university, you know, and I was thinking, me, university? I was 37 then. I didn't even know anybody who'd been to university. I didn't even know what the language meant, you know, seminars and dissertations. I thought, what's all this stuff? I don't know any of it, you know. It would be like Educated Rita. I don't know if you're too young to know that film, but some people know. Anyway, so I went and I just absolutely loved it. Although I was very shy still, I didn't like to speak out in class, answer any questions, but I did really like it.
What did you study?
I studied English literature and English language, because English was the only thing I was ever good at school. You know, I wasn't any good at anything else. And I did, but I never knew I would go into higher education. I didn't think that was for me. You know, I thought I was just working class, and I never thought I would lead that kind of life. And then go on to work in the prison. I became a teacher in prison. I took a PGCE and then taught literacy and then started Storybook Dads. So it was just one thing led to another. There wasn't a plan of what I was going to be or do. It just kind of happened. Then once I got my teeth into it, once I enjoyed working in prison, I liked that it was a great leveller and there's a lot of humour, and just enjoyed the environment of helping people to overcome their shyness or their inhibitions, because I knew what it was like. You know, I was exactly the same. And I mean, one of the things we do is all the editing, because there's about 100 prisons send us all the recordings to Channings Wood Prison in Devon, and we do all the production there. So we train a team. Usually it would have last, well, before the pandemic, it was about 14 prisons, and we train them to be editors, and they've become really quite highly qualified audio and video technicians.
That is amazing.
Yeah, well, when they first come, they think, I can't do this, I can't do this. But you can, you can't. And, you
know, imposter syndrome, isn't
yeah,
it?
So it's just, God, I know what it's like to think, I can't do it. I, you know, I'm out of my depth. I don't belong here. And a lot of prisoners won't go to the education department. All prisons have education departments. And a lot of prisoners won't go there, you know, because they feel it represents failure, embarrassment, exclusion, you know. But sometimes when they come to us, it's like education by stealth because they're doing it for a purpose. And just letting people understand that they can learn is the biggest barrier, you know, or they can be better parents, or they can, you know, they don't have to be held back by everything in the that they've known so far. There are ways forward. And I think that's something that I bring to it from my own experience, really.
Sharon, you are an absolute inspiration. Oh. And I love, I could talk to you all day.
Thank you.
I'd love to ask you four quick fire questions. So who are the women, or is that maybe one woman, who has inspired you?
I thought a lot about this, and there's quite a lot of sort of different sort of famous women that have gone on to achieve a lot. But if they had to say one woman that inspired me the most, that would have to be my mum, you know, because she was full of compassion and kindness, and she would never turn anybody away from her door. She would always just put on some extra food, and she just cared so much about everybody. And I think that's rubbed off on not just on me, but in our whole family, that, you know, you try and see the good in people. And I think that is probably something that has stayed with me and fed into my work quite a lot. You work with a lot of prisoners, and some of them have committed horrible crimes, and some of them have been criminals for a long time, you know, career criminals, they call it. But there are usually reasons for that. So I think it's the ability not to judge. I'm not, you know, like a bleeding heart and feel sorry for everybody, but I do know that sometimes you have to know what it's like to walk a mile in a person's shoes, I guess. So I think, to answer your question quickly, it would have to be my mum, I think. She's not with us anymore, but she definitely had a huge impact on the way I view people and life.
Absolutely beautiful. I'm sure she's very proud of you. What one piece of advice would you give your younger self?
I guess not to be so shy. I didn't have a lot of belief in myself, really, as a younger person. I went traveling, and it wasn't like I was an introvert or anything like that, but I was quite shy. And also, you know, like I say, I just didn't think I could lead a different kind of life. So I think it would just be believe in yourself and try lots of new things.
Love that. And what's the one thing you can't live without? This is a very hard question. The four of us sat down together and answered this, and we had all sorts.
Okay. I guess for me, living where I live, it's being outside, you know, because I live it's about a 20-minute drive to the beach. It's about a 20-minute drive to the moors. And I live 5-minute walk from a nature reserve. So I think for me, just having that peace and being out in the countryside. Yesterday, for instance, I was up on Dartmoor with my sister swimming in the river, and it was fantastic. I know it was boiling hot, but I mean, I've been known to swim in the river in November, so that isn't necessarily, you know, always to do with the temperature. So, and I think when you spend a lot of time in front of a computer, like I do, you know, sometimes hours and hours, it's really important to get outside and spend some time walking or running. I used to run, but my dog's too old now, so she can't run, so I just walk. And swimming as well, because I do love to swim. So just, I mean, I'm lucky to live in Cornwall, and I certainly make the most of it. It's what nourishes me and keeps me going, I would say.
And what a place to be locked down. I can imagine that must have been such a saving grace over the last year and a bit.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I did feel for so many people, and when we were allowed out 1 hour a day, and I'd go out walking in the beautiful countryside, and I thought, all those poor people, you know, who are in the middle of a city, and they're not even allowed to go, they're going to go out for an hour with their children, and how horrible it must have been. So not to have, you know, this on your doorstep. So I can't imagine what it would have been like.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And what is the one thing about you that would surprise people?
Oh, I don't know.
Give us a good one, Sharon. We want the scoop.
I don't know. What's the one thing that surprised people? Well, my guitar's in the background. I play the guitar a little bit.
Oh, that's brilliant.
I used to write songs when I was younger. That's why I wanted to be a writer. I thought, I want to write songs and be on Radio 4 and write plays and all that kind of thing. So, yeah. So it's that. But I probably think the thing that would surprise most people is just how shy I was and can be up to a point. You know, I still don't, oh, I've got used to it. You know, and it, as in my role, I've had to go to lots of functions and dinner parties and, you know, award events and mingle, you know, around. And I found that incredibly difficult in the beginning because it's not, you know, I just always don't find it easy in crowds. But so shyness, I think, would surprise people given what we, the charity, has achieved and, the, you know, what we've done. And I've had to just go here and go there and just go to a prison, mingle with everybody. I think there's shyness and public speaking, overcoming public speaking. I've had to do that a lot as well. And that crippled me.
Do you work with a coach or how do you overcome that fear from public speaking?
Public speaking, I take a beta blocker and it does a trick. So the doctor prescribed them for me, and because I did one, and then I was supposed to do a speech for, it was, I'd won an award, a Butler Trust Award, and they said, can you come and do a speech for this next year's winners? And I said, all right, where is it? Buckingham Palace. And I said, you've got to be kidding me, I can't do a speech in Buckingham Palace, you know. So I was so frightened. So I went to the doctor and he gave me some beta blockers, and they're amazing. It's like magic.
Because does it really work? That's incredible.
Absolutely, it works like magic because it stops the physiological response to stress. So your heart doesn't race, your mouth doesn't go dry. You know, it doesn't. It's not like taking Valium, which might affect your thought processes. It's not that at all. You know, but it was just like magic, and I thought that's amazing. So maybe that's the one thing that when I'm public speaking, you can be sure I've had two beat blockers.
Absolutely brilliant.
I may look confident. I go, hi, everybody. It's so good to be here. You know, but there's a reason for that.
I've learned something new today. Well, I love that. Do you have fond memories of attending the Women of the Year lunch? What year did you go?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember when it was now. I don't know. It was quite a long time ago. But it was a lovely lunch. It was really lovely to talk about everybody's achievements, and I remember the lady from Birds of a Feather was sat on my table. They were Dorian. She was sat on my table, and I had a little chat with her. So it was nice actually just to go to a women only event. I've never been to a women only event ever. You know,
it's so special. It's that sisterhood and everyone rooting for each other, which is, you know, what this is in an audio format. Really celebrating wonderful women, and you know, people like you are such an inspiration and give us hope. And you know, we have so much to learn from what you've done.
Thank you. But yeah, it was nice to just be with at a women's event and just celebrating each other. It was so relaxed and so much fun, you know. It was great.
Well, Sharon, it's been an absolute delight to speak to you today.
You too, June, you too.
So many gems. And, you know, I just feel that, you know, we're so lucky to have you doing what you do.
Thank you.
A lot of courage to run a business, and I know how much sacrifice it takes as well. So we are very grateful that you continue to do, you know, great work and bring families together and give people hope.
Thank you.
What wonderful joy Sharon is bringing to lives of separated families. Hello, I'm Leonie Mellinger. I run my own business as a communication skills advisor, and I'm an actor. It's my great pleasure to welcome actress Tamsin Outhwaite, who shares her memories of the first time as a Woman of the Year lunch guest and why she's become such a stalwart supporter of the event.
Firstly, thank you for having me, and also that particular Women of the Year awards, because last year was the virtual one, so it was less... there were less people in the room, but that first experience was a real eye-opener of an awful lot of my idols and people that I've been looking up to for years were in the room, of all different backgrounds, cultures, professions. And so it was really wonderful to be there. I was sat at a table next to Isabel Waller-Bridge, Phoebe Waller-Bridge's sister, who's a musician and composer. And I had a wonderful time talking to her because we had lots of similarities family-wise that we just nattered on about. And also the other side of me was a children's author called Cressida Cowell. She's a really brilliant author that both of my kids had read her books. The main thing was I felt as soon as I sat down was, oh, well, I'm getting a cultural overload here, music, you know, literature on either side of me. And I suppose I felt a little bit unworthy of being there, of actually being there.
I had a young lady on my table who was so overwhelmed and excited.
I remember.
She burst into tears. And you were so wonderful with her. You hugged her and you took her around the room. And it was like what the highlight of her life, she said, meeting you.
Oh, well, she became my sidekick. And that became, you know, an added extra bonus for me, because obviously seeing someone so happy from you doing so little was a lovely thing. And what I did was I took her around to meet some of my idols. So she was like, I was holding her hand and I took her to meet Floella Benjamin, who when I was a kid was just the woman that I looked up to. She was the woman that taught me about Handel and the windows. And, you know, as far as I was concerned, as a play school baby, it was like looking at your favourite teacher that you've ever had.
Oh,
and more. So I took this lovely girl with me and we met her and lots of other riders. It was lovely. Athletes, all sorts.
I remember one year I was sitting next to the then director of public prosecution, Alison Saunders, and her greatest excitement was that on our table was a member of the Pussycat Dolls. So it's just so funny.
Getting the mixture right, I suppose, because obviously I felt like, oh gosh, I shouldn't be here. I haven't done anything that's, you know, all I've done is my job. And all these people are incredible. And it does make you feel, but then I suppose for them, they're looking, it's like when people say about actors get really starstruck by sports stars, like by footballers and vice versa, you know. So I suppose it's looking at a different, you know, either a different profession or a different achievement. There's something about a group of women that feels very, very powerful when you're all in one room. You know, it's the amount of, it's not even power, it's the amount of empathy, it's the amount of, you know, warriorness that feels like it's all around you. If that's a word, it's definitely not.
That's a great word, warriorness. That feeling of warmth and support in the room is fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think now that we have so many different professions where women are part of them, that we still need organisations like Women of the Year?
Oh, yes. I don't think you could have enough celebrations for women, for me, being a woman. But I mean, it's, you know, the suffragettes isn't that long ago. So it still feels to me like we are still celebrating equality. Therefore, with equality and with everything that we have built as a structure, which is, you know, not just the home life, you know, and to be fair, I have an awful lot of friends that are house husbands, you know, that do that what women were generally expected to do. And just as well, maybe. But I do think that everything that's gone on over the years, it's still not that long. We are still getting used to the fact that as a woman, we can, you know, be the CEO of a company at the same time as a housewife. But the juggling, which is what we do naturally, I think, which comes naturally to us, which is multitasking, which doesn't always come naturally to everyone, still feels like it should be celebrated. And that's basically what we celebrate. We're celebrating that you're not just that huge high achiever, but you're also a mum, you're running everything. You know, as a woman, what you're doing for society is incredible. And I don't think we should ever stop celebrating that, no. I don't see why we should stop celebrating women and their achievements. You know, it's not people generally should be celebrated, I think, but it's not been very long, as far as I'm concerned, that the equality has been, you know, we are still fighting for lots of things, whether it's pay, whether it's age, whether it's, you know, whatever the discrimination. So therefore, I think when there's a breakthrough and when someone is achieving something that's extraordinary, it should be celebrated, yes. I think we have made a lot of progress. There's a lot still to be done around age. There's a lot still to be done around race. There's a lot still to be done around the pay gap. All of those things, definitely. But I know, and most people in my circle and in my network and in my tribe know, that if you want something done, you ask a busy woman. You don't ask a woman that's got nothing to do. You don't ask a man that's busy or a man that's got nothing to do. A busy woman is always where I would, you know, trust my life with that person, because it means they can pretty much juggle most things. And a busy woman that's also a working mum, yeah, you can plan my party for me any day.
Well, Tamsin, thank you so much.
Thank you. Lovely to talk to you.
The Extraordinary Ordinary was brought to you by Women of the Year. To find out more about the organization and its history, the lunch, and the Women of the Year Awards, go to www.womenoftheyear.co.uk or find us on Instagram at Twitter at Women of Year. For more information about or to support Storybook Dads, go to www.storybookdads.org.uk or on Instagram at Storybook Dads. Many thanks to our brilliant producer, Claire Lynch, and to you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please share these extraordinary, ordinary women with your friends and family.
The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank. For nearly 40 years, Silicon Valley Bank has helped thousands of innovative businesses and their investors move bold ideas forward fast. With tailored financial services and expertise, Silicon Valley Bank helps address the unique needs of the innovation ecosystem across all business stages. Learn more at svb.com/UK. Silicon Valley Bank, built for what's next.